Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Fertility Podcast. I'm Natalie Silverman, your host. If you've just found me, welcome. There's a plethora of episodes. I was looking at my iTunes, actually, just to look at the numbers, and the numbers of the episodes are all higgledy-piggledy. So I would say go back to the start, but you don't need to. You can search by topic. I've covered a whole range of things that might be affecting you whilst you're trying to conceive, as well as spoken to loads of different people. So you can dip in and out either in your favourite podcast app or via the fertilitypodcast.com website. And I love hearing what you think, because what I'm going to be sharing again with you today is the episode that Kate Davis and I have put out on UK Health Radio. For about 6 weeks now, I've been co-hosting my podcast with Kate, who's a fertility nurse and is amazing. And you've been saying you're really enjoying the science bit, so please keep letting me know what you think of this kind of new slant on the Fertility Podcast. You can email Natalie at thefertilitypodcast.com or via the Fertility Podcast website. There's a contact me page and you can get in touch there. Now, what I'm sharing with you is another male fertility focused episode, because such an important topic. We had Rod Silvers last week, and we're going to be hearing from a guy called Gareth James. And we're also going to be hearing a snippet of a former episode I did with Jonathan Ramsey, who's an amazing urologist. And you'll have heard his name come up in some of the conversations that I've been sharing about male fertility, because he's so prominent in the work he does. And I just wanted to share with you an email that I've had. A lovely lady called Becky got in touch to say, I was really interested in the male factor infertility episode, as that's what we're experiencing at the moment, and it's so hard to find people going through similar situations. My husband is taking part in research on the recommendation of Jonathan Ramsey, which I thought I'd share with you in case it might be of interest to your audience. It's about studying causes of male fertility, since there is so little research, and you get a free semen analysis, a DNA fragmentation test, and a testosterone test. Now, apparently they are really struggling to get men to take part, and you'll know if you've heard my content before, I really want to fly the flag for men to know what is out there for them to get as far as tests and advice. So I'm going to put a link to this research in the show notes for this episode. So please listen to the end and I'll give you the details of the show notes then. If you're on the move and you have to stop or what have you, just go to the Fertility Podcast and type in the word research and it will come up. But it will be my most recent episode, which I'm now putting out at the start of August 2019. For now though, before I share this episode, all that's left for me to say is I'd love you to rate and review this podcast via your favourite podcast apps. Lovely getting your 5-star reviews. It gives me a nice warm cuddle, especially as I've just had a very brief summer holiday because my little boy got chickenpox. You might have heard me share on my socials. So I nipped to Croatia for 5 days and back. I was meant to be there for 10, but we had to miss 5 days whilst the pox happens. But yeah, it's one of those life experiences, I guess, that we've had and we won't have to have again. So your reviews are really appreciated. When I had my little, oh, woe me moment with my summer holiday being slightly dampened, and then I came back to floods in Manchester. The UK is just being bombarded by crazy weather at the moment. Wherever you're listening, though, I hope you're doing all right. I hope you're finding this change in the content really useful. And now here is my conversation with Kate and with Gaz, our guest. And don't forget, the show note details of this research I just mentioned will be at the end of this episode. So welcome to another Talk Fertility show, and we've got a bit of a theme going on at the moment in that we're focusing on male fertility. It's something really important to me. It's something that I've got personal experience of, and it's something that I know in the work I've been doing with the Fertility Podcast, we need more men to speak up. And last week, Kate and I had a great conversation with Rod Silvers, who just provided such a kind of ray of light on what is a difficult conversation as well, didn't he?
Oh gosh, he did. I just loved talking to him. It was fantastic. Really good. Really good.
And one of the things that came out from that conversation was the frustration that men often feel. And I'd ask Kate to have a listen to an interview that I did for the Fertility Podcast, which is where I was putting my content out before Kate and I started this show, because I'm yet to share it. And Kate had a listen and we decided that we'd share it as a follow-up to the conversation we had last week with Rod. It's unrelated. It's a guy called Gaz who had contacted me on Instagram wanting to share his story. So I interviewed him and I've since given it to Kate. And Kate, I know you were quite frustrated by the conversation, not what Gaz were saying, but what Gaz experienced, weren't you?
Yeah, I think I had quite an extreme reaction listening to Gaz. I mean, it was fascinating listening to him, and his anger and frustration really came out in the interview. But I just felt so frustrated. Actually, I then messaged him after listening to it because I felt so compelled to tell him how I felt, because I was really quite surprised at the reaction that I had. And it was surrounding the frustration. And you know, I do see this a lot where men are the forgotten partner, the forgotten equation to the fact that it takes two to make a baby. And they're often ignored by the clinics. They're not investigated. And certainly in Gaz's situation, it was absolutely devastating. He'd gone through, I think, three rounds of IVF, and not once had he been considered. And now he sees and finds himself facing, you know, a huge male factor issue, which wasn't identified during his IVF through the NHS. And now he and his partner are looking at potentially funding private IVF since they found out that it is a male fertility factor. And I just think it's just so devastating, so sad and so frustrating that he's gone through all of that and now is facing further invasive treatments, further expense and further emotional turmoil. When had that been identified and addressed a lot earlier, it might have saved all of that.
Well, have a listen to Gaz, and we will pick up again at the end, because you'll also hear Gaz explain how, unfortunately, because of the time wasted, age really isn't on their side now, because his partner is just past 40. So that has all sorts of other implications. Have a listen, and then we'll be back at the end to give you our details of how you can get in touch. So I'm now going to welcome Gaz to the podcast to talk about his and his wife's quest. I'm trying to avoid the use of journey, because it's male factor. And Gaz and I have been in touch on Instagram, and Gaz has kind of been through it as far as almost worst case scenario of how male factor infertility is treated. Gaz, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Natalie. Thanks for having me.
And I know that we're kind of in the midst, we've just been chatting, we're in the midst of what had been a kind of complaint procedure. What I want to just start off with, Gaz, was your original diagnosis. Were you told it was unexplained when you were first kind of going and asking questions because you weren't able to conceive naturally?
No. At the beginning, we thought it was more to do with my wife because she'd had polycystic ovaries.
Right.
And due to her age, she was in her late 30s. So they presumed, obviously, her fertility had declined. So I did a couple of semen basic semen analysis right at the beginning, and they came back, I think, quite low on morphology. They said count and motility were reasonable. So the focus was from the beginning put more towards my wife, and my wife did a lot of work in trying to improve her own fertility, and you know, throughout the whole process. NHS and the fertility clinic didn't really pay a huge amount of attention to me. And I remember the doctor at the fertility clinic saying quite a few times, well, your side of things isn't really that important because we need one good sperm. And if you've got a count of 20 million, 15 to 20 million, which is on the low side, you know, we still stand a chance of finding one good one out of that many. So never really had much focus put on my fertility.
It's quite remarkable, isn't it, that ultimately it takes two, yet one person's told doesn't really matter about you. Rather than being told to stand the most optimum chance, you could do X, Y, Z to make sure that your swimmers are shit hot.
Yeah, never really got any advice on trying to make sure. I mean, they obviously advised me that they told me that they wouldn't progress with treatment if I was still smoking, which is fair enough. And they said, oh, try and cut down your alcohol intake a little bit, but there's no real information on, you know, what sort of natural supplements you can take to improve your count and morphology. And if we had had a lot more help at the start, you know, it wasn't until really towards the end of the third cycle, so after 3 years of treatment, I even found out that my count was quite low. At the start, when I was told, oh, you've got a count of 20 million, I thought, oh, 20 million, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
But at the end of the third cycle, I found out that for natural conception, you really need a minimum of 30 million. So it was a bit of a shock to find out, yeah, I did have a quite a low count.
Especially when you're asking those questions. I mean, were you asking, is there anything more I can do? Or were you just so overlooked? Because I know that the men that I speak to, they often feel completely ignored in consultations.
Yeah, I would say completely ignored, because my wife, it was all about my wife to start. She had a lot of tests and a lot of scans to make sure everything was ready for treatment. But yeah, no one ever mentioned anything to me. And it wasn't until we went for a viability scan on our third cycle of ICSI that one of the nurses actually mentioned, oh, as you've had repeat miscarriages, you might want to think about getting the sperm comet test, which I'd never heard of before.
So those previous treatments had all, you'd had a successful kind of implantation, but then it had resulted in miscarriage.
Our first cycle, we had successful implantation. My wife was pregnant from blood and the urine test, but we went to our viability scan at 7 weeks. And we didn't know this. We thought if you had positive on your pregnancy test, you know, there was a pregnancy, it was growing. But we went for our first viability scan at 7 weeks to find that there was a sac growing, but nothing else. So the sac is what gives off the hormones that give you the positive pregnancy test.
Yeah.
But obviously the embryo inside had... Well, we don't know at what stage it stopped developing, but it wasn't there. So we'd done these pregnancy tests. My wife had all the symptoms of being pregnant. We went to our 7-week scan thinking, oh, we'll find out today if it's one or two, because obviously we had two put back in. So we thought there may be a chance of twins. And then we knew something was slightly up because the nurse was taking a long time to try and find anything. And she said, oh, I'm really sorry, but I think it's just an empty sac. So it was, yeah, devastating, yeah, because it was completely unexpected. So, and then our second cycle, we didn't get implantation, so there was no pregnancy. And then the third cycle, we got implantation, we got pregnancy. My wife felt all the same symptoms again. And we thought, I think the technical term for it is blighted ovum, which is quite rare, I think. And we thought, we can't be unlucky enough to have this again. So again, we went to our 7-week scan thinking, is it going to be one or two? And again, the nurse was looking a bit uncomfortable, struggling to find anything. And she said, look, I think you've had the same thing again. So yeah, really hard to deal with, because we thought two pregnancies, one of them would have worked. But there's more and more research now coming back that poor sperm quality is linked to miscarriage. So
she mentioned the sperm comet test, which is a paid for test, which at that point, after the third failed cycle and that miscarriage, you then went on and had?
Yeah, the nurse mentioned it at the viability scan, where we got told about the miscarriage. And she said, I mean, it's advertised in the clinic, but the doctor had never mentioned it to me. And I'd said to the doctor, after speaking to the nurse, look, shall I have the sperm comet test? Is it worth doing? And this is a consultant now who'd been looking after us for 3 years. She said, sperm DNA fragmentation is not really an issue, because the egg will repair damaged DNA in the sperm. And after speaking to Dr. Ramsey, he said that does happen to a certain extent, but not in women of my wife's age. My wife is she was around 40 then, and he said it just doesn't happen. So that was part of my complaint to the HFEA, that this consultant was giving me the idea that I have sperm DNA damage, and that's proven now because of the sperm comet test, but it doesn't matter because my wife's egg will repair my damaged sperm.
Yeah, so it's incorrect advice.
It's just, yeah, Dr. Ramsey, who's, you know, one of the leading experts, said it's not the case. It's not going to happen.
So what happens next? I mean, you're obviously devastated. You're getting conflicting advice from experts that you've put your trust in. You've got this result. You're now in the very capable hands of Dr. Jonathan Ramsey, who I'll put links to conversations I've had with him on this podcast. At that point, do you kind of say, right, we need to stop and look at what we can do?
Well, yeah, speaking to Dr. Ramsey, he said he believes that my infertility, the DNA damage, he can't say it's definitely reversible, but it is. There's a possibility it can be reversed.
Well, treatable at least.
Yeah, I have high levels of oxidative stress, very high levels, which may be damaging my sperm. He can't say for sure why I have high levels of oxidative stress, but another test has confirmed that my sperm are produced and in good condition, but there's something, as soon as they leave, there's something in my body that is causing them damage. So I'm seeing Angela Heap, the fertility nutritionist, as well, I'm on a load of natural supplements to try and see if we can reverse that. I'm trying to reduce my stress, trying to make a lot of lifestyle changes.
Give me some examples of what you're trying to change, if you don't mind.
The amount of exercise I do and the kind of exercise. I'm trying to make lifestyle changes, so me eating a more healthy, balanced diet. I have reduced my alcohol down to virtually zero. I gave up smoking a few years ago.
What exercise were you doing and are you doing? Were you gymming or cycling?
I do CrossFit, which isn't great for the stress levels in the body because it's quite high impact. So yeah. I am trying to reduce that slightly and do some stuff that is a bit more low impact and not quite as high stress. So
more yoga, less CrossFit.
I've done quite a bit of yoga and stuff like that.
And how does that feel? Because that's obviously something that, you know, you get a buzz out of in a positive way, and then you're told that actually that has to change. Are you dealing with that? Because that's a stress relief, doing exercise in itself, yeah. To then have to look at that.
Yeah, I mean, I can't stop. I can't give up because it's good for my mind as well.
Sure.
I have to do a certain amount of exercise each week. It makes me feel mentally better as well. So I can't give it up, because if I give it up totally, then I don't think in my mind I would be as happy, and then that affects it.
Sure.
That could affect my fertility again. So, you know, we're going to give it 6 months of making all these changes, and then I'll go back and have another sperm comet test. It may be that there's been no improvement, and then, you know, we'll have to consider our options again, that maybe pregnancy naturally isn't going to happen for us. But obviously, if we'd have been told all this information 3 years ago when my wife was a bit younger, our chances would be a lot higher. Now she's over 40. If we try ICSI again, I think her chances have gone from 30% 3 years ago to women over 40. I think it goes down to about 10%. So,
right. And that emotional strain on the pair of you, that frustration caused by that 3 years, how are you coping with that? I know that, you know, we've been talking, and I've been in touch with your wife initially. I know that you're part of the kind of Insta community and there's support there, but are you getting counselling elsewhere?
We've both had to have counselling to help us deal with it. But we're in a position that we're at an age where all of our friends have children. And so some have had to go through fertility treatment to have children, but they have had children through fertility treatment. We're the only couple who have been through fertility treatment and still have nothing. So it's quite difficult for us because we don't have any other couples to talk to we can talk to couples who've been through fertility treatment, so they know a bit of what we've been through, but no other friends have been through multiple rounds, had multiple miscarriages, and, you know, are still at the start of what could be a very long, difficult road. So it's difficult. We would like to find other couples who we could maybe meet up with around Essex who are in a similar position to us, but we just don't know anyone at the moment.
And the difficulty being as well that this conversation with the urologist, this understanding of a urologist being somebody that specializes on male factor infertility, the tests that are available, is a conversation that I try to highlight, that I know you were keen to talk to me to highlight. It doesn't seem to be happening early enough, which is why I was, you know, delighted that you're happy to talk about it. And I know that you have raised a complaint against your clinic and against the NHS. And sadly, it's kind of not been taken on, in that you've said, haven't you, that they've said they did what they kind of stuck to their guidelines or their procedures and have operated as they seem fit.
Yeah, the NHS have obviously a policy on how to deal with couples struggling to conceive, and obviously every couple is different. And we were quite unfortunate that I think we were one of the rarer cases where there's both been issues on both sides, and we've had a series of quite unlucky events. And the NHS have just stuck to, well, our policy is for everyone. And I mean, other experts have said, yeah, and the NHS policies will be several years out of date, because the thing with fertility treatment is every month it's advancing. So the NHS are behind the times, haven't updated their policies, and have cost us three years of our lives. I mean, there's a cost as well. The NHS have spent thousands of pounds of our taxpayers' money on our treatment, when had they done a £400 test at the start, they could have said, well, actually, until we see some improvement in your semen analysis, you're not going to be suitable for ICSI or IVF or whatever. But if you take the next 6 months to make some improvements, then we do another test, you might be ready for treatment. And then, I mean, effectively, they've wasted three rounds of ICSI on someone who should have been treated differently at the start. And then we may never have needed ICSI, because had we been able to reverse my infertility, you know, Dr. Ramsey still said natural conception could happen. But it's going to be more difficult now, my wife's approaching 41, not 37.
I mean, it is that conversation. Obviously, we're talking about the NHS, but you were having NHS-funded treatment within the realms of a fertility clinic. So you'd hope that if you've gone down the route of having those initial tests with your GP, maybe you get referred to the fertility clinic. Once you're in the fertility clinic with a low count, that there is at least some conversation about the sperm test, which I'm still at a loss as to why that doesn't happen. It didn't happen with us. You know, we had ICSI treatments. We were successful with our ICSI treatment, so I know it's a different story. But when we later went to speak to Jonathan Ramsey, there was things that he was saying to us that, you know, were never said. And it's that multidisciplinary triage method of approaching this, involving a urologist earlier. I mean, do you feel now that if you'd have been in that clinic 3 years ago with some knowledge of even what a urologist was, you know, you'd be more empowered to just even ask, to say, well, hang on a minute, I know about this now. I mean, because this obviously is our aim for any other men or couples listening.
Yeah, I mean, even if the doctor we saw right at the start, I mean, we're not necessarily saying the NHS should have referred me, because the NHS say they'll only refer to the urologist if you have a low sperm count. And on my first test, I think it was around 20 million. And their definition of low is under 15 million. So
yeah.
I wasn't far out, but it was enough for them to not think it was an issue. But I mean, even if at various points throughout the procedure, if any of the NHS doctors had said, look, it's not in our policy to refer you to, but if you want to go and get a second opinion and pay privately, it might be worth you speaking to a urologist. But nothing's ever mentioned. And we're quite lucky that we would have been able to pay the private fees, but if someone had said to us, look, there's a few more things you could do, but you're going to have to pay for them yourselves, we'd have done it straight away. But the doctors we saw didn't even mention anything. So we do feel like we're given minimal information about it.
Yeah. And as we've said, then therefore are at the end of three failed cycles. So what we ultimately are looking at is highlighting the lifestyle changes, the additional tests that can be done. I mean, even if after one failed cycle, you know, you'd have had this. I get that if a couple are tested and, like you said, your sperm count wasn't low, because they have to have some criteria to manage it, but you have the first failed cycle, that then things are changed, because it sounds like each time you went through the treatment, nothing was changed.
No, I think the NHS policy is they don't really start investigating things till you've had three miscarriages. I mean, we were quite lucky this time that we'd had two, and they actually sent the second, well, both miscarriages. My wife had to have a procedure where the sac and the bits are removed. And on the second one, they did actually send off the sac for analysis to find out if there were any issues. And it turned out there was a chromosomal issue.
Right. Which again can be linked back to sperm quality and sperm DNA fragmentation.
Yeah, all the information we've received so far, everything points back. Poor sperm quality. And during our complaint with the NHS, they'll just sit there and say, well, your count wasn't that bad, your morphology actually improved a little bit, and your motility wasn't that bad. But it makes sense to me that, yeah, those things might all be all right, but what if what's contained within the sperm isn't good? So that's contributing 50% to the potential baby.
Yeah.
But if that 50% is damaged, isn't that going to make a big difference?
What I was referring to earlier was actually the cycles of treatment, the fact that you had a failed cycle, and then, I mean, what time frame was between the different cycles? Were you given much time?
We did take quite a bit of time between each cycle.
So during...
My wife wanted to make sure she was as prepared as possible for each cycle. So
your wife was doing all she could to prepare herself, yet you were completely in the dark about what you could be doing to prepare yourself.
I had been making changes. Obviously, I'd cut out alcohol virtually altogether. I was being better with my diet and doing more regular exercise. But most of this was based on private experts that we'd seen that were telling me to make these changes. None of that information came from the NHS or the fertility clinic.
So the conversations we had earlier about seeing, for example, Angela, changing your nutrition, those changes were made during those failed cycles?
Well, my wife was probably making big changes. She made small changes up to the first cycle. And then after the failure of the first cycle, she started to see a lot more experts, and then started to make big changes the second and third cycle, whereas I was probably a cycle behind. So I'd made a few changes for the first cycle, but then started to make more changes on the second cycle, and on the third cycle, take it really seriously. I was only taking it seriously based on information I was getting from private experts, nothing to do with NHS or the fertility clinic, because I think the consultant at the fertility clinic kind of made out that making all these lifestyle changes wasn't going to have a massive impact on my semen analysis. So the private experts who said, no, we sometimes do see big differences based on you making these changes.
I guess that's the biggest point here, is that there's no guarantee, as we know, with fertility treatment of it being successful. But ultimately, we want to try and give ourselves the best chance by doing all we can to improve ourselves without it being a risk to our health and our well-being. Hence the traffic light system with add-ons with the HFEA, hence there being hopefully more awareness and education about what we can do. And when it comes to diet and nutrition and supplementation, there is a lot of evidence, and Angela is a big advocate for evidence-based practice in what she does to help people understand that changes can happen. And what's obviously frustrating is that you're then going back into the fertility clinic being told, no, it's not going to make any difference. So you're left feeling totally conflicted in you want to do the best for yourself, yet you're not getting the support from the one place that you're putting your trust in to make it happen.
Yeah, we feel really bad now, not because, I mean, obviously we had three rounds of fertility treatment funded by the NHS, which we thought was great. But now looking back on it, it wasn't great. It's actually been worse for us because they've not given us good information from the start. So they've let us progress on for 3 years. Whereas if we'd been given really good advice at the start, I'd rather have had one round of treatment and just make sure that we were as prepared as possible. But the NHS don't seem bothered about preparing you for fertility treatment. They kind of just throw the treatment at you.
Yeah.
And hope that it works. But after 3 years, I wanted to make sure we'd given it every possible chance. And now we look back on it and think, well, we've been through three rounds of treatment and we never actually gave it the best chance because we didn't have the right information.
So you're at a point now where I know you're looking at different options, and I'm assuming we're talking about now privately funding treatment.
To be honest, we're just still not sure. Personally, I don't want to go through fertility treatment again because it was incredibly stressful. And obviously, now our chances have gone down to about 10%. I mean, we have looked abroad, and the total cost would still be a large amount of money abroad for a 10% chance. So we're kind of throwing everything at treating my infertility in the next 6 months in the hope that we may be able to conceive naturally. If we don't conceive naturally, we've looked at embryo donation, because obviously the chances of success with that would be much higher. So that might be a consideration. Or we have started talking about adoption.
Okay.
But in terms of going through ICSI again, unless I see an improvement in my sperm quality, I'm not sure it's worth attempting again.
But as sad as that is, it's empowering that you have the power in your hands to decide what you do next, which is the whole point of this conversation and the frustration that you didn't before, isn't it?
We've had to become kind of our own doctors and try and find out as much as possible because with the NHS, trying to get any information, if you do get any, it's so outdated, it's no longer relevant. But they just see everything as a doctor, obviously. So it's in terms of natural supplements and things like that, there's no research that's going to help you. But if you speak to people like Angela Heap, who've been doing this kind of work for 10 years, then she has seen a lot of positive results. But because they're not in medical studies that doctors read, doctors, will push it all to one side and think, no, that's a load of nonsense.
Yeah. Well, we can only try and fly the flag for functional medicine by hoping, people listening to conversations like this and, communities like there is on Instagram get to hear. And I know that you're talking to the press in a hope that story can be shared. So thank you for telling me. Thank you for sharing. And I mean, one piece of advice that you'd give to a guy listening right now, we've talked obviously about the changes you've made and the questions that you've asked. What would you say?
If they're about to start or going through fertility treatment, then I would give them the advice to make sure they look at their own fertility as well, because a lot of men, if there's problems, I know a few people have been like, well, I don't want to get the test done. I think it's all my wife's issues or whatever. I go and see a urologist and get all the tests done that he'll offer. And obviously there's a large cost because the NHS aren't going to do it, but for the sake of maybe £800, you could find out a lot of what's going on with yourself, and it will save a lot of time.
And emotional heartache.
Yeah, it is money well spent.
Gaz, thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for the chat.
And keep me posted on what happens. And good luck with this next round of tests. You're in safe hands. I'm delighted when you told me who you were working with, because they're all people that I've had on this podcast. They're all people who I rate very highly. And at least you sort them out. And hopefully, like I said, by us talking and by sharing those names of those experts that can give you the guidance to ultimately, hopefully, have success naturally, then we can collectively help more people.
Yeah, that would be our dream scenario. So fingers crossed.
Yeah. All right. You take care.
Yeah, thanks very much. Thank you. Bye.
So, Kate, I know when I'd sent you this and when we talked about this before listening, you were talking about your frustrations with Gaz. And one of the things that he had said to me was that the pair of them were looking for other couples that they could talk to who might have experienced something similar. And I thought that was something that we could maybe put out here on the show, to say that if anybody's listening and has found themselves going through treatment that has since been identified as male factor, and as a result it's meant a loss of NHS funded treatment, whether the situation has to be identical to Gaz's, but I know he was really keen to share his story, but also to see if there was anybody else who might have been experiencing something similar. Is there anything that you've heard about with any of your patients?
Yeah, I mean, I hear about that a lot. And actually, when he said that, my heart completely went out to him, because he talked about the fact that they've got lots of friends who have either conceived without a problem, or, you know, a small smattering that have had to have IVF but have then gone on to conceive. And so he and his wife feel so isolated that they don't have any common ground with any of their friends on this situation. And he was desperate. He and his partner are desperate for to find some people that they can talk to that have gone through similar, not identical, but similar situations, and that how much that would mean to them to be able to talk to other people. And I think, if I'm right in thinking, is he based in Essex in the UK?
Yeah, I think so. Right? Yeah. I think he is.
So yeah. I think he said to you, didn't he? I think he said, you know, if anyone, you know, out there is based in Essex. So anyone out there based in Essex, please get in touch with us, and we will put you in touch with Gaz, because it would be amazing. And even if you're not based in Essex, wherever you are in the world and you feel that you would like to reach out to Gaz, then please let us know. And, you know, it would be great for the two of you to kind of get together and to offer each other some mutual support.
And he's really kind of vocal on his Instagram. And I've also put him in touch with, there's a BBC documentary being made about male fertility and male infertility issues. And Gaz is going to be talking to them. And I know that they were keen to spread the word. So I will put a link in the show notes as well. And it's on my socials as well, this post about this documentary that's being made. If you're a man listening to this and, you know, you're identifying with some of these topics and you would like to talk more, please either get in touch with myself or Kate on our socials. We'll give you those in a sec. Or email us, talkfertility@gmail.com, and we can point you in the right direction, put you in touch with Gaz as well. Now, that email is also for questions, and we've been gathering your questions, because every week Kate likes to answer them, because she is brilliant and has a wealth of knowledge and is a medical expert in this field, whereas I'm just a constant chatterbox in this space. So I'm bringing Kate to you to answer the questions. What have we got today?
So we had a lovely email from a lady who said that her husband has low testosterone and they've been trying to conceive for 4 months. Her endocrinologist has suggested that to the partner that he loses weight, so it's surrounding weight loss. And she asked, was there anything else that I could advise? So to answer the question then, losing weight, if you're overweight, then losing weight will definitely help increase testosterone levels. So that would be the first thing to absolutely do. But there are lots of other things that you can do. And certainly having a healthy lifestyle is one of those. Not smoking, reducing your alcohol content, exercising, those type of things. But it might be that if testosterone levels are really low, that she needs to seek advice from her GP or consultant, he needs to seek advice from GP or consultant to consider the possibility of testosterone supplementation. And you can take testosterone by testosterone gel, and that will help to increase testosterone levels and ultimately increase sperm count, because that's what you really want to do. So that would definitely be my advice.
Very useful. Thank you, Kate. Right, as we said, get your emails into talkfertility@gmail.com if you've got any questions as a result of that one, or any questions on any of the topics that we've discussed, or things that you've been trying to get your head around. You can also follow us on our socials. I'm at Fertility Poddy on Instagram and Twitter.
And I'm at Your Fertility Journey on Instagram, and on Twitter, I'm at Fert Journey.
So I was talking at the start of this episode about Jonathan Ramsay, who you heard us discuss in the conversation with Gaz. And here is a snippet of when my husband and I went to meet Jonathan, and he looked at our results and he just gave us a really, as always, interesting insight, which is what Jonathan does, into, I suppose, what we experienced with regards to how we were treated. Have a listen. You'll hear my husband chatting a lot. I do pop up every now and again, but it's predominantly my hubby, which I'm really proud of him for getting involved in the conversation, I have to say.
As a rule of thumb, one looks at the total motile sperm count as being a predictor of natural conception. And so on your better test, the total motile sperm count is the numbers, the concentration, times the volume, times 45%.
Right.
So that's about 5 million. And if you've got a motile sperm count of 5 million and quite a few normal looking sperm, then your chance is certainly not zero.
Right.
So the cumulative chance of a pregnancy over 2 or 3 years in a man with a total motile sperm count of 5 might be something in the order of 20%.
Right.
Now, there's not much research in this because, of course, ever since ICSI was developed, exactly what happened to you is typical.
Yeah.
So here's a couple, 2 years without having had a baby, low sperm count, the lady's 36, we're all feeling a bit worried about this, we're pushing against an open door, just do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it is a one response fits all. Now, is that wrong? Well, not necessarily.
Yeah.
But society has decided that that's what we're going to do.
Yes.
The funders have decided,
yes,
whether it's your funds or the government's funds, that's what we do. Now, of course, behind your question is, could we have improved this such that there might have been a natural conception? And the answer to that is yes.
Right.
But on the other hand, you two represent the reason that the gynecologists would argue that ICSI as a first response is the right response.
What would you mean by that? Why?
Well, because you succeeded.
Right, that's what you're saying.
What they said was, this is absolutely straightforward.
Yeah.
This is a low sperm count,
yeah,
in brackets. You'll never do it naturally.
Yeah.
Very demeaning for you to hear that.
Sure.
But to say you'll never do it naturally, of course, justifies a big intervention.
Yeah.
You have a baby, QED, intervention justified. Sure. But you're absolutely right that, of course, it's more likely that that intervention, if you look at the statistics, it's more likely that it would have failed than succeeded.
Right, yeah.
Twice as likely to fail as to succeed.
Yeah.
And of course, the problem is not so much for you two, because you succeeded, but the problem is that if you, exactly the same people, had three goes that hadn't worked, which statistically could have happened, then you two feel even worse because you think, well, we were told the only way of doing it was ICSI.
And now
it's failed 3 times. So the consequence of that is that both of you are upset, demeaned, emasculated, and many couples just sort of stop even trying because they think, well, we were told that the only chance was ICSI, it hasn't worked, so now we're stuffed. So let's look at the alternative. If one had done more tests here, some hormones, possibly an ultrasound to see if there was a varicocele, that sort of thing, make sure there's no sign of inflammation or infection, then one could have, not saying that we would, but one could have bounced up the total motile sperm count from 5 million to 10 or 15 million, and you might have done it naturally, whilst waiting for IVF.
Mm.
So it could have been different.
Sure.
But actually, seeing as the outcome's a baby,
yeah,
we're there.
Yeah. But obviously, from, like you say, one size fits all doesn't necessarily fit all.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So, at this time, were you taking any medicines, going to the gym?
Well, yeah. I mean, at the time, I was working as a personal trainer, so I trained a lot.
Yeah.
And as a consequence, I did change a lot in my lifestyle. I tried to, anyway. So I stopped cycling. I stopped eating soy products.
Uh-huh. Was that before this test?
It was before the second test, I think.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was before the second test, wasn't it? Because tight underpants, all of the...
When we got the first test back, we then researched for ourselves what we could change.
Yes.
What we thought we could change.
Do we know what the sperm test was when you came to have the IVF?
No, I don't. I didn't have a record of that.
And were you, Richard, taking any supplements?
Yeah. I mean, I worked for a nutrition company, interestingly, so I used to use a lot of their supplements.
Did you?
Yeah. But I still sort of do, and did all the way through the IVF treatment. But some of those are soy-based, but I cut all the soy-based ones out.
But were you taking any bodybuilding stuff?
No.
Any
creatine? Oh, no, I don't. No, no.
And nothing that could have been testosterone-based?
No.
Or?
I mean, I assume they test the sample, the semen sample, at the point of...
Yes.
The
reason is that most men faced with that total motile count of 5, again, typical, a month later it's actually apparently worse.
Mm.
But if one had thrown everything at you,
yeah,
then one would expect that best one to have improved a bit.
Sure.
And that's without any other investigations at all. So I would always investigate a bloke like you fully,
sure,
on the basis that actually you had quite a lot of normal looking sperm on both counts, you had reasonable motility on one of them, and a total sperm count on one of them, 10 million.
It's interesting, sorry, that you said that, because I remember...
We weren't told that at all.
Well, I remember sitting with the second guy and him basically saying the complete opposite.
He said the problem's with you.
But he said that you've got low mobility, most of them aren't even working.
Well, you see, that again is typical, because we're only going to have one outcome. So this is one of the interesting medical consultations.
Yeah.
That is the IVF consultation, the fertility consultation, in which there is only going to be one outcome.
Sure, of course.
Which is IVF.
Yeah.
So everything that is said has to justify that outcome, because we don't have any other possibilities.
Yeah.
There are no other alternatives.
Yeah.
So the one thing, and this is only human nature, this isn't wickedness, the one thing an IVF specialist will never say, well, not never, but is unlikely to say, oh, well, I'm sure we can improve this, or this isn't too bad, because once you start saying that, then there's a conversation about a male semen analysis and what you could do.
Yeah.
Then there becomes a necessity to investigate it.
Mm.
Now, even if the gynecologist theoretically knows how to investigate it, within the funding envelope that is fertility treatment, there's no money to do that.
Yeah.
There's no provision.
Yeah.
So everything in that consultation has to be aimed towards the outcome. It's the ultimate example of manipulation.
Yeah, because ultimately, unless they do the IVF treatment, there's no funding on their part.
There's no other place to go.
Yeah.
And you don't want to fill the bloke's head with all kinds of sort of wicked ideas that he could be normal.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, crikey. Because then quite frankly, the private sector certainly, you're losing customers.
Sure.
So I'm not saying that they reached a wrong conclusion.
Well, no.
But because it could have been the right conclusion, but they reached it on zero evidence. The only evidence, real evidence, and this they would point to, is that you'd been trying for 2 years, and Natalie was only 36, and there are plenty of motile sperm. So they're saying to themselves, okay, So this is a fair deal. They haven't done it naturally. He's got some sperm. She's only 36. Let's just do it.
Yeah.
And on one level, that is perfectly fine.
Well, we got the outcome we wanted. But to get to that decision, I think we both really struggled. You know, the process of sort of being told it's basically like you've got no hope, you have to do
well,
this.
Well, I've got a letter here because we complained to that clinic about how we were told, and this is the letter in response inviting us back for another test, to which we were never going to, because it was, I think I said when we first spoke, it was the 23rd of December, and we were told, you've got no hope, this is your only hope. And it's interesting you say you're only 36, because the way we were told was that it's because you're 36, you need this.
Yes, everything pushes.
Yeah.
They're little incremental pushes, so...
It's
not wickedness, it's just the way it happens.
No, of course.
But with that being the case, could they not have said, you could go and have some more investigations, but you'd have to pay for them? As in, to Rich, because we asked for advice and we weren't given any.
Well, they could have done, but then, of course, they have to know how to interpret the investigations. And seeing as they've never, ever done anything except IVF, they don't really know. I mean, in London now, only one of the clinics is beginning to send patients off to see urologists.
Now, just to say that I spoke to Jonathan Ramsey in May 2017, so it may well be now that more clinics are doing what he said. Okay, the show notes for this episode are thefertilitypodcast.com/mailresearch. Okay, so there I'll put the link to the full episode with Jonathan Ramsey that you heard a snippet of. I'll also put this link to the research that I mentioned, which is basically trying to find out the causes of male infertility. And as a result, if you're a man that takes part, you get a free semen analysis, DNA fragmentation test, and testosterone test. They really need more men, and I'm going to be speaking to them more to get more information to hopefully share with you. But for now, all the details will be on the show notes. Thank you, as always, for your ongoing support. And until the next time.